Welcome to Relationships 2.0 with author and clinical psychologist, Michelle Skeen. Michelle and her guests will endeavor to guide you through the pathways for self-understanding that'll help you create and maintain safe and healthy relationships. You can find Michelle on the internet at michelleskeen.com. Now the host of Relationships 2.0, Michelle Skeen.
Welcome to Relationships 2.0. I'm Michelle Skeen. My special guest today is Mark Coleman. He is the author of Make Peace with Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Michelle. Very nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So I was reading about you, and one of the things that I found really fascinating and resonated with me was your love of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much a big nature lover.
And I'm wondering, as someone who runs mindfulness workshops, among other things, and I'd love for you to chat about that, how does nature help people maybe get in more of a place of mindfulness, be more in the moment, be more present? Is that one of the reasons that you are drawn to nature?
Yeah, I am drawn for many reasons. And it's certainly been a big feature of my work over the last 15 years. And my first book was called Awake in the Wild. And the subtitle is really relevant to this conversation, which is Mindfulness in Nature as a Path of Self-Discovery. And so I've been trained in the Buddhist tradition in the last 30 years and, studied intensively in typical centers, monasteries, temples, etc. And when I moved to the States and discovered the wilderness here and the vastness of the beautiful wild lands, I began to take more and more time outside, and take my meditation outdoors and my retreats outdoors. And I realized that nature was such a profound teacher, and many of the teachings that we look for in the wisdom traditions are so evident outdoors, whether it's a sense of interconnection or peace or a sense of understanding the transient nature of things, letting go, both joy and sorrow and non-judgmental beauty and acceptance. And so I just found that for me, the place I wake up the most, I become the most mindful, contact presence most easily, is outdoors. And so I started sharing that with people because I wanted people to also see that nature is this profound, beautiful teacher and resource that's always available, you know, right outside your doorstep.
I agree. I think it is really has so many lessons to teach us. And I know that most of my experiences, like real awakenings, have come when I've been outdoors on some sort of adventure. And in March, I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and I was just rereading the journal I kept, and it was, you know, it's an experience that will never leave me and continues to provide lessons and gifts.
Yeah, no, it's, I think there was a research study done some years ago now and asking where people experienced the divine or the sacred or God or whatever people refer to it as. And I think it was something like 85% of people said it was outside. It was in nature, you know, whether it's the ocean on a mountaintop or, you know, in the simplicity of your garden, listening to the birdsong in spring. It's a profound teacher and resource and, you know, especially in these times, you know, where, you know, there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of angst around the political situation. And I think we need, you know, to nourish and restore and renew ourselves. And nature, in my experience, and I think it's true for many, is a beautiful place and a way to do that that's very accessible. If we bring, and this is the key, if we bring a contemplative awareness, we can go to the most beautiful place and be on our cell phone or lost in the trance of our thoughts. So what I'm teaching is how to bring a contemplative presence into nature so we can actually be present and receive those blessings and teachings and really wake up to the beauty and the fragility that's there.
There is, you know, you mentioned the cell phone, and I think it's so difficult for people, for all of us, to put it down, turn it off, leave it behind when we go do something. It's really difficult for people to disconnect. Are there ways that, are there tips that you can give people that can allow them or have them view it a little bit differently?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock last week on loving presence. And we do this ritual now at the beginning of retreat. Spirit Rock is a meditation center in Northern California, for those people who don't know it. And we asked people to give up their cell phones for a week. It was a seven-day retreat. And we do this ritual where people actually, you know, it's like a ritual around withdrawal and addiction.
Yeah, and like amputation, probably, right?
Right. And so, and it's very profound with people. And actually, one of the reasons I like teaching in the wilderness is because most cell phones don't work. And actually, we're forced to be with ourselves and forced to be present. And I think it's, you know, one of the simplest practices I have people do around cell phones is buy an alarm clock. Like, don't take your cell phone to bed.
Right.
You know, don't use it to wake up, because we jump on email and then that's the day, you know, the contemplative sweet time in the morning is over.
Right.
And even just that simple thing of, like, you know, I turn my cell phone off a lot in the day. Just if I'm meeting a friend, I don't need my cell phone on. If I'm watching a movie, I don't need my cell phone on. If I'm driving my car, you know. And so just simple ways where we start, we're not using that, you know, that reflex of going to the cell phone every time there's a spare moment.
Yeah, and I think it's really become, you know, for all of us, it's a little bit of, you know, I realized, so I was at the Apple store and I'd left my phone because I was getting something fixed on it. I can't remember now. It was something to do with the battery. Oh, no, I'd cracked my screen. And then when I went back to pick it up, so they said, oh, well, just give us a couple of hours, which was nice. And so I was killing some time, and then I went back, and I was sitting there, and I noticed that everyone was looking down and on their phones or on an iPad, and I was sitting there, and I didn't have anything. And normally, I would have brought, like, a lot of times I'll carry a book with me, or I'll carry some kind of reading material if I know I'm going to be waiting around somewhere, and I should just probably always have something like that. But I noticed how I was feeling a little bit anxious. I wasn't proud of it, that I was sitting there and I was like, I don't have anything to look at. You know, I'm just, and so I was looking around and, you know, I was noticing things, but the main thing I noticed is how accustomed I've become to just having that phone, and how it is kind of this, you know, like a pacifier, you know, serves the purpose of a pacifier to just kind of, you know, calm down your anxiety or emotions, and that I really didn't like that I felt the way I felt about not having my phone.
Yeah, it's kind of humbling. I'm sure you're familiar with this study. There was a research study done, I forget where, that asked people to sit in a room by themselves, a plain room, no cell phone, and do nothing for, I think it was 10 minutes. So they had the choice of doing that, or they could be in the same room, do nothing, and self-administer an electric shock, a mild electric shock. And I forget exactly what the percentage was, but it was quite high. It was in the, I don't know, in the 50%, something like that. The people chose to have electric shock rather than simply be by themselves in a room doing nothing. Like, people would rather experience pain. So, you know, I mean, it's amazing that smartphones have only been around since 2006, which is 10 years, and yet it's transformed our relationship to ourselves, and it's reduced our attention span. It's reduced our inability to be present. You know, we now have this thing called slow rage, where people just get frustrated if they have to wait more than a nanosecond for something.
Oh, that's interesting. Say more about that. It's called slow rage.
Slow rage, yeah. So, you know, you're on your computer and we expect, you know, pages to, you know, download or
right.
websites to load instantly. And, of course, sometimes they don't. And then we get, you know, we go into a fit if something takes 2 seconds versus, you know, 2 microseconds. And so
right.
we built this impatience habit. And I think we're developing shorter fuses as a culture. And certainly our attention has gone down from 12 seconds to 8 seconds in the last, I think, 10 or 20 years. And goldfishes have an attention span of 9 seconds. And now humans have a shorter attention span than a goldfish.
Wow.
So it's all very humbling, which is why, you know, I talk yeah. about in the book, mindfulness and compassion. You know,
yes.
it's essential that we have a practice, that we cultivate attention and focus and awareness,
right.
because our culture and our devices are really scattering and diminishing that capacity.
It's interesting because I notice reading your book, or I mean, even before I started reading your book, Make Peace with Your Mind, that you have a lot of short chapters, and not, I mean, not all, I mean, you have 31 chapters, these like little bite-sized pieces, and I'm seeing more and more of that with books.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it kind of speaks to what you were just saying about people's attention span.
Yes, I mean, I fall victim to that myself. If I'm in a bookstore and I see a 600-page book, I think,
right.
well, I'm probably not going to read that.
Right.
And I actually purposely designed this as a slim book. I mean, it's 200 pages, but it, you know, in the scheme of things, it's not a big
right.
book.
Right.
And I partly designed that because, one, the topic is kind of heavy. I mean, who wants to really sit down and read about their inner critic? It's not the most favorite of topics. So I wanted to make it sort of concise, accessible, light, and humorous, really, because, you know, it's important to find humor and lightness and playfulness
yeah.
with these critical voices because it is heavy. And I also know that format works for me and it works for other people where we want, you know, bite-sized chunk of information and then we can digest and go off. And we've sadly lost that luxury of time where we dive into, you know, these encyclopedic books.
Yeah, I have a couple of those really big novels that
mm-hmm.
I have that are aspirational, that are on my night table, that I think that would be really amazing to be able to accomplish reading one of them. But yeah, there's a lot going on. I also think, I mean, for the purposes of your book, Make Peace with Your Mind, I think that it can also be difficult for the short chapters are helpful because I think some of the stuff that you address in your book, people already have kind of they've created an obstacle around it. So, you know, this buzzword mindfulness, everyone should be doing mindfulness. Everyone should be meditating. And I hear people say all the time, that sounds great, but I can't do it. I can't pay attention. And every time I sit down and try and have nothing on my mind, it doesn't work for me. And so I think it's nice that you present, first of all, break it down, which I'd love to have you do here, but I think there are a lot of misconceptions about what mindfulness is, and I think it's really intimidating to people and easy to a lot of people and easy for a lot of people to straight arm it. So how do you feel about explaining it in the most accessible way that you can to kind of help people see the power in it?
Sure. Yeah. So obviously, you know, it's become very popular, and it's popular for a reason because it does work. It's very effective,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very complex, multifaceted, you know, thing. It's like talking about love. How do we define and you know, explain what love is? It's a complex subject, and so but simplifying it, you know, mindfulness is really you know, another word for mindfulness is clear awareness, mm-hmm. the ability to be present, the ability to know what's happening in your experience with a quality of attention that's not reactive, not judgmental, that's fully present to the experience. And we all have that capacity. We all have this, you know, we're all mindful at times in our day where we're consciously knowing, oh, I step out, you know, the front door and there's a beautiful sunset and I'm aware that I'm just paying attention to the sunset. And that's mindfulness. Or we're walking the dog and we're mm-hmm. really enjoying the you know, the morning walk, or we're, you know, sipping a cup of coffee and we're just fully present to that aroma and taste, right? And we have many, many moments of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we, as we've been talking about, we have many, many moments where we're spaced out, where we're in that ruminating mind, where we're lost in thought about the past or future, where we're reacting to what's happening or we're rejecting what's happening, and we're not really present. You know, the many different research studies have pointed to, you know, that we're, you know, present, you know, we're only present, you know, a certain part of the day. You know, the Harvard study, I think it was 46.9% of the day that we're present, which basically means we're spaced out half the day, or we're thinking and lost in thought.
46. And oh my gosh,
I know, it's pretty demoralizing.
Yeah.
So you know, and so I joke about that is we sleep, you know, a third, you know, for 8 hours, and if we spaced out another 8 hours, we're only present 8 hours a day. So by the time we're 60, we've only been awake for 20 years of it. So, wow. You know, life is a beautiful, amazing, mysterious thing, and
right.
and why not be present for the whole performance? You know, and of course, there's hardship and stress and pain and all of that, but there's also much beauty and love and delight. So mindfulness is a state. It's a quality we cultivate, and it's a practice. So, you know, there's so many different mindfulness practices coming out of, whether it's the Buddhist tradition or other traditions, that are training us how to cultivate this capacity to be aware, to be present. And the good news is anybody can cultivate mindfulness, and we can grow this skill and train the mind to be more aware, which of course then develops more self-awareness. And we can grow and establish it so it becomes the norm rather than an odd time in the day when we happen to be present. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Is part of what role does flow play when they talk about flow? Like, is that mindfulness as well? Is that when someone is in the moment?
Yeah, that's an interesting relationship. So, because there's an overlap. And, you know, people like Michael Jordan talk about, well, I was thinking of being in the zone, which is similar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the flow state that I know from Mihaly, or however you pronounce that name, is where we have that balance of engagement, where there's a healthy amount of stress, but we also have the balance of skill. So we're really in the zone, we're present, time flies by, we're flowing. And in a way, I think that mindfulness is required as part of that. Just like for a great athlete like Michael Jordan, when he's seamlessly playing on the court, you know, he's obviously very, very present of himself and of the play and of others, team members and the opponent's team.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a state of incredible, you know, present moment awareness. And so in that way, they're similar.
Okay.
I think where mindfulness has a slight shade of difference is that in flow, we lose ourselves. Like, we, and our artists or programmers talk about losing themselves for hours.
Right, or maybe even when we're writing.
When we're writing, exactly. But with mindfulness, there's a conscious awareness of being present to what's happening. So we're not just writing and absorbed in it, but we're consciously knowing that we're writing.
Okay.
And it's a difference.
Okay. So is it kind of mindfulness, would that be more of a, like an observer self, like you're aware of yourself in the moment?
Yes.
Okay.
And the challenge with it is, you know, when we say that word observer self, it sounds like I'm distant and detached from my experience. We're very connected and intimate with experience, but we're also knowing it.
Okay.
So it's encased in that awareness.
You cover so many great things in your book, so I'd love to do a little jump around a little bit with some of the topics that you cover. So you're dealing with the inner critic, and you're using mindfulness and compassion to help people deal with their inner critic, and we all have usually a really loud inner critic. And one of the times that the inner critic, I think, shows up is when someone is having a lot of regret about their behavior. In fact, one of my clients contacted me today and is just having a lot of regret about something that, you know, about behaving badly. So not being her best self. And
sure.
that the inner critic looking back at maybe bad or unhelpful behavior can be really harsh and difficult to tame. Talk to us about what you recommend for what you call 2020 hindsight.
Mm-hmm. Well, sadly, I know this phenomenon very well. My critic is a specialist in 2020 hindsight, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, very easy to look back on past decisions around relationships or what we did with our money or where we decided to live and look back and go, well, that was, you know, from the clear light of day from today, it was a crazy decision or an unwise decision, right?
Right.
But of course, in the moment, we're doing the best we can with our limited resources and information
mm-hmm.
and skills. And so what the critic does is, you know, very harshly criticizes and judges and shames us for what we've done in the past. And one of the challenges with the critic is when we're judging ourselves like that, it actually inhibits the capacity to look honestly and to bring a spirit of inquiry. So, for example, say we have, you know, say we did something or said something that was very hurtful because we were triggered and we were reactive, and we often say things we regret when we're triggered.
Right.
The critic will come in and just say, well, that's terrible. You're a bad person. You know, I can't believe you said that. You should be ashamed of yourself. And it will stop the ability to inquire into, hey, why did I get so triggered? And where did
mm-hmm.
that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And so and also it makes us collapse into unworthiness. And when we're feeling unworthy, the last thing we want to do is inquire and understand and get to know, you know, how we can make how we can learn and grow and develop. Instead, we collapse into this sense of feeling bad and unworthy, and much more likely to repeat the experience because we haven't been able to inquire and learn from it.
Well, because we're probably engaging in behaviors that are helping, that are designed to temporarily help us feel better because we're experiencing such bad feelings about ourselves, right? So to be curious, like you're saying, or inquire about why we did something bad, you know, for want of a better word, then to learn something from it can feel like, oh my gosh, I'm dwelling on this. Like, I already feel bad that I did it. I don't want to, you know, look at it or talk about it or think about it. I want to get rid of this. This feels awful, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so the critic, you know, and I want to make this important distinction, the difference between the thoughts and the judgments that come from the critic versus, in this case, say, you know, we're trying to discern what happened. Why did I get triggered? Why did I say that very hurtful thing, right? We need that to grow and to understand. And when we're working with ourselves or people or making decisions in the world, we need a lot of, you know, critical faculties that have this ability to discern and distinguish and discriminate and to assess and evaluate, right? They're all very healthy, you know, everyday functions of the mind. But the critic comes in, and rather than using that skill of discernment, will just say, well, that's terrible, or that was stupid, or that was wrong, or you shouldn't have said that, you should feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't, you know, we can't get to the bottom of the reactivity, and therefore we keep reenacting and repeating those things, because the critics just shut down any possibility of inquiry and learning. And so we really wanted to be able to distinguish with and that's why I suggest cultivating mindful awareness, because we turn that attention inward and we start paying attention. Well, you know, these thoughts that are repetitive, you know, is it a negative thought that's attacking my sense of value and worth, or is it a thought that's really helping me understand and grow and learn from my experience? And so we really want to, you know, sort of identify and isolate the judging thoughts that actually lead to a sense of collapse or hopelessness, because we want to hold those with more, you know, more attention, more clarity, and to be mindful about not buying into, you know, the implications of what they're saying.
Right. No, that totally makes sense. What about how self-compassion or compassion plays a role with the inner critic? And, you know, people have, that's another, I think, idea that people have thoughts about and maybe don't understand. And a lot of times, well, I went to a mindful compassion workshop with Kristen Neff, and one of the things that they talk about that comes up with a lot of people is that, oh, if I practice self-compassion, it's going to make me come across as weak, or, you know, I'm not going to be productive, and all of this kind of resistance against using self-compassion. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and your experience with offering this as a solution to people?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, there's obviously a lot to say about self-compassion because it's such an important topic. And I mean, the first reason I talk about it is because the critic and the messages it's telling us and the beliefs that we develop in relationship to it, of feeling bad or unworthy or whatever, you know, it's very painful. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I've worked with people for 20 years now, and I see that I think it's the number one cause of our mental suffering is the way that we talk to ourselves and berate ourselves and punish ourselves and unforgiving of ourselves. And so just to meet the pain of that, I think it's important that we first cultivate self-compassion. We feel the pain. We turn towards it with a kind attention. And we actually feel, like I remember when I was probably about 20 and I started to feel in meditation how painful it was to talk to myself. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I really let the pain in of how harsh and how cruel it was to talk to myself that I began to want to find a way to not, you know, listen to the critic and not give it so much power and authority. And it's true, I often hear when I'm giving these talks and workshops on the inner critic, people say, well, if I didn't have my judge, I'd never get out of bed. If I didn't get out of judge, I'd be a slob and my house would be a mess and I wouldn't make any money. And,
right,
you know, and I say, well, you know, I think there's much better. We have so many resources to draw on within ourselves, aside from chastising ourselves to get out of bed. You know, we can use inspiration and motivation, and we can reflect on the meaning and purpose in our lives, and we can think about, you know, gratitude and the positive things we might want to contribute. And there's just so many different ways to motivate ourselves, and rather than coming from a deficiency model of, oh, I should be doing this or that because I'm bad or useless or unworthy, you know, wanting to do work and to do work on ourselves and learn and grow, because, you know, that's, you know, enhancing our capacity and our well-being. And so I just think it's really important that we realize we have so many other skills. For example, like when we're making ethical choices, people say, well, if I didn't have my critic, how would I decide what's right and wrong? I say, well, that's what conscience is. Conscience is, we, you know, when we hurt somebody, say we get angry and we shout at somebody,
right,
and, you know, our children, we feel it. I mean, we know when we're out of alignment with the truth. It's just our body, it will reverberate. And so we want to be listening to that sense of instinct and intuition and conscience, rather than the critic that has a very simplistic view of what's right and wrong and good and bad.
What is, you know, when you say, I just want to, I mean, I am in complete agreement with you about your message in this book and self-compassion and all of that, but I want to be a little bit of an agitator, because I know that people are still skeptical, that there are people who are still skeptical. So all of this, like, inspirational phrases, when you're not feeling great, that can feel like really naive, you know, like to just read for someone, you're like, oh, really? I'm just going to read this phrase or develop a mantra, and this is going to get me motivated. You know, I need that drill sergeant who I'm afraid of, if I don't do what he tells me to do, he's going to make me do even more things, right? He's going to make me do, you know, more push-ups or whatever. You know, people who feel like, yeah, that someone who just says, okay, well, you know, why don't you just do what you feel like doing today? Oh, did you only feel like doing 2 push-ups? Okay, well, you're doing your best. You know, that kind of idea, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm presenting 2 extremes, but how do you get people to buy into that the person who is understanding and kind is actually going to be also motivating? Maybe we like them, but how are they going to motivate me? They make me feel good.
Right. Yeah, well, I think, you know, we could look at it that way. We could look at the other way, which is, if I listen to that voice that, you know, I need to get out of bed because I'm, you know, a slacker, or I need to work harder because I'm never going to get my stuff together. And if we keep listening to that voice, we basically get on this treadmill where it's never enough,
mm-hmm.
you know, because no matter how many push-ups or how much money or how much whatever success it is, that voice is it's never enough.
Right.
And so,
like, the goalpost gets moved, the bar gets raised. It's never, it's like, okay, well, you did that. Well, you're not done. You're you feel like you're never done. Mm.
Right. So I think that's, you know, to be looked at is the danger of listening to that voice and following its, you know, basically mm-hmm. stick in its whip, is that we constantly feel not enough, got to do more, got to get more, and it's sort of unquenchable. And so what I'm trying to advocate is, you know, there are different ways, you know, to motivate yourself.
Yeah.
And using the stick is just going to create more power for the person who's wielding the stick. And is that what you want to be creating in your mind? You know, and if you don't want to get out of bed in the morning, and the only thing that will get you out of the bed is that voice, then maybe there's something about the very thing that you're doing that's problematic. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I feel like the messages that we get in our culture is very much kind of like the stick, right? You never get to just sit with where you're at. I'm sure this has happened to you. And I mean, I even find myself asking this question as much as it feels like it's just automatic. But so this book of yours just came out. How often have you heard, well, what's your next book? This book just came out.
Right.
But I bet people have asked you when what's your next book, right?
Right. And it's like, oh, that's not good enough. Or, you know, where did you make it on the Amazon ranking?
Exactly. Or... it's not just that, okay, this is a beautiful contribution. This takes so much work. And obviously you're really passionate. And all of these things that were what drove you to write the book. But then it's, how many reviews do you have? So do you make a lot of money from books? The answer, everyone, is no, unless you are a New York Times best-selling author. We actually do this to help people, not to get rich.
Right.
And, or even things like, you know, someone gets married and it's like, oh, you just got married. When are you guys going to have kids? You know, oh, you just had a kid. When are you going to have another one? You know, or, oh, you just got, oh, you just like bought a house. When are you going to get a new car? I mean, it's right. never just about that thing. And it makes it really difficult for us to just sit with ourselves with that. Right. And also to not get defensive, which is that inner critic, right?
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. It's, you know, I have a chapter in the book called The Not Enough Mantra,
right.
and Never Enough Mantra. And it's pervasive in our culture. You know, it drives the GDP. It drives our shopping and consumption. It drives our, you know, workaholism, that we don't have enough money, looks, youth, fame, wealth, you know, degrees, books. And it's very sad to think, you know, we have so much, you know, so many of us have so much, you know, we live in the Bay Area, right? What a beautiful,
right. yeah,
you
that's
know,
enough.
Progressive, abundant place to live. And yet we're always looking at the neighbors or the Joneses and who has what, and who has the higher degree and the bigger book sales and the nicer car and whatever it is.
Right.
And so we live in this sense of impoverishment when we're so actually so abundant, and you know,
right.
and I know that's sort of been co-opted by the New Age, but it's really true that we have so much, and that's why I talk about gratitude practice in the book,
mm-hmm.
because it's a counterpoint to that scarcity mind that the critic and we have, not just the critic, but it's also in the culture that
right.
that we live with this sense of scarcity, and it's very unhealthy, you know, sad, and it's also very it's inaccurate, and that's partly why I talk about the critic. And not listening to the critic is because its perception is actually distorted. It's skewed, and we need a more accurate self-perception and reality perception.
So oftentimes we are comparing, I mean, I would argue, you know, almost all of the time, comparing our inner experience with other people's external, like, presentations of their experience.
Right.
And especially, this is particularly fed by social media, right? I'm the only one who is unhappy right now, because if I look on, well, I don't have Facebook except as like a, you know, my Facebook page for my radio show, but because I know that I would probably be miserable if I was on Facebook. But I do have Instagram because my kids post things on Instagram, and it's just, you know, kind of fun. But I do know that everyone is posting, you know, from what my clients tell me. And by the way, a lot of them are made very miserable by looking at Facebook and seeing what people are doing, or looking at what their ex is doing and
for sure.
who he or she might be with. And wow, they look really happy. How are they so happy after the breakup? I'm miserable. Am I the only one who's miserable? Why is everyone so happy? What have they figured out that I haven't figured out? And
right.
that's a quick trip to misery. That's really, really challenging, I think, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think so. I think we're living in this, you know, age of social media where, you know, of course, but it is true that we present our, you know, best shiny self, which is just one slice of the pie.
Right.
And if we really believe that, you know, a critic comes in and says, look, you know, your ex is really happy, or your friend, look at your friends, they're, you know, doing this thing and that thing. And
yeah, they went on this fabulous vacation.
Right. And everyone looks happy and healthy. And why don't I have that? Why don't you have that? What's wrong with you? And so all of that scarcity, critical, comparing mind, it just keeps spiraling back. And this is where the critic is so hampering, is it keeps circling back to this thing of what's wrong with you?
Right.
What, you know, you must be a problem. There must be something flawed and deficient in you. And that's why it's so painful, because it keeps looping back to this thing of we're not good enough. We're unworthy. We must be, you know, less than, and you know, it's often so far from the truth. You know, some of the people, like there's a chapter in the book called The Imposter Syndrome, where these fabulously successful people like Meryl Streep, who says, you know, why would anybody want to come and watch another movie with me in it? I can't act anyway. You know, she's the most Academy nominated and awarded actress, you know. Well, John Steinbeck says, you know, I don't know why people read my books. I can't really write. Or
right.
Sheryl Sandberg, the CRO, fabulous leader from Facebook, says, oh, if people really knew who I was, I'd get fired, you know.
Right.
And so we suffer, you know, when we listen and really internalize those voices, we believe we're a fraud, we're fake, we're not good enough. And if only people really knew, they would leave me, they would fire me, they would never associate with me. And, you know, and it's a distortion because, you know, one of the things I do on my workshops is I have people write out a list of their top 5 or 10 self-judgments, which is hard to do just to put it on paper. And then, of course, there's fear that someone's going to see them.
Right.
And then I have them actually share them with another person, which is, of course, brings around a wave of terror in the room. That they actually have to share their inner demons. But it's actually very healthy and it's very normalizing, and it kind of takes some of the sting of the shame out because we realize, oh, we've kind of all got the same similar voice. We're all hard on ourselves. We all see ourselves distorted.
Right.
And it's not really true. I say to people, go home and share this with your loved ones and friends and ask them, is this really true that I'm a loser or I'm unlovable or I'm never going to find happiness? And they'll say, that's not how I perceive. I perceive you as with these strengths and qualities. Yeah, and you know, we've all got work to do. We've all got stuff to work on, but it's not who you are. It's not how I see you.
Right. And it's also this idea that it's not a fixed state. Wherever we're at, this isn't a fixed state, right?
Right.
But when people are stuck with that inner critic, I think the inner critic can do a number that can make you feel as if you can never get that all of whatever issues you're dealing with are plaguing you because you are deeply flawed and they will always be with you and there's no way out.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the ways to recognize the critics at play, not just the critic, because this happens with other kinds of thoughts, is the words always, should, and never. You know, you're always going to get it wrong. You never are able to find what you're looking for, right? And we hear these words and we go, oh, wait a minute, that's probably the critic and her friend at play. So, you know, and it's really, you know, and especially if it's about the future, you know, we really want to hold those thoughts with such a, you know, such a grain of salt because we can't know the future. We can't know something's always going to happen. We're always going to lose money or we're never going to find love. And like, who knows? Next day, you know, who knows what life is going to be?
Well, and you can, that kind of predicting, you can actually turn it into a self-fulfilling prophecy as well, which you talk about in the book, right? So this idea that, I mean, if you are in this fixed state of mind that's helped by the inner critic, if you always behave as if what your inner critic says is true, then you will actually, you know, prove your inner critic right.
Yes, and we'll get into all kinds of self-sabotaging habits. If we think we're unlovable, we will find a way in relationship for that to be proven, and we'll do something that allows people to almost like prove that we're looking for ways to make ourselves
push them to behave toward you in a way that proves that you're unlovable. And I think that's important to look at the relationship component in all of this and how buying into these thoughts about yourself and what the inner critic is telling you, how that impacts your relationships. And you address that in the book. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. And I think it's really, you know, and I know you've done a lot of work around relationships. I think the critic really, you know, has a lot of play in a relationship. So, for example, there's a chapter in the book called the swing door, which is, you know, the critic goes in, goes out, and basically, you know, the essence of neuroplasticity is what we practice and habituate and cultivate, we become. And so if we practice judging ourselves a lot, most likely we're going to judge other people, including our spouses and family mm-hmm. and loved ones. Mm-hmm. And if we practice judging people a lot, most likely when we're home alone, we're going to judge ourselves. And so we want to be mindful if we have a strong critic, which most of us do, it's likely to play out with our partners and to be judgmental of them, to be harsh of them. Or conversely, we project our judgment onto them. And right. we think they're criticizing us and judging us. And of course, often it's just an assumption that's not true.
Right.
And so, it's really important to both see how in a couple we can criticize each other. And it's really important to interrupt it, you know, just as in the chapter I have called The Critic Toolkit, where there's lots of these strategies to work with the critic. We can also work with that critic outwardly, and if our partner's, you know, being, you know, negative and judgmental and critical in a way that's really undermining our value, then we can say, hey, wait a minute, that's judgmental, as in it's really not just a comment about an action that or something I said, but it's really an attack on my well-being, and let's find a different way to have this conversation. Can you say that in a way that doesn't feel like an attack? It's
yeah.
just a statement, or it's an I statement. So I think it's really important that we interrupt each other's critics from attacking each
right.
other.
Right. And bringing awareness to one of the things that I realized about myself is that when I start having really critical thoughts about other people, it's because I'm feeling really bad about myself.
Right.
And it's kind of like my inner critic gone wild, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I try and bring the awareness back to myself and say, okay, what is going on with you right now that has you not feeling good about yourself and has you being so critical? And mm-hmm. and bringing awareness to that has really helped me, because I think it's really, I see with people frequently that the ones who are really critical of other people are so critical of themselves.
Right.
And it's almost like they're critical of other people because they can't take it anymore, you know. I don't know. How would you explain that?
Well, sometimes it's a way of deflecting from themselves.
Right.
You know, and it's a way, you know, we can use the critic in a way to inflate ourselves. You know, well, at least I'm not that person. So we put
right.
others down because we need to artificially prop ourselves up.
Exactly.
Which, of course, only works until the next person comes along that our critic thinks we're inferior to, and then we crash. And
right.
So it's a never-ending, painful cycle. But, yeah, no, I think it's really important to look at, you know, where the critic comes from, why it comes out. You know, often it comes out because we're feeling vulnerable, we're feeling mm-hmm. sensitive to being judged or rejected or criticized, so we judge ourselves before others can, so we can
right
you know, kind
of beat them to the punch
right right
a little bit. And you
yeah.
can also tell that, I mean, that's an interesting kind of reaction to notice in people. And it feels to me and sounds very different than just someone who, you know, has this kind of like self-deprecating way of, you know, occasionally of talking about themselves. This is really seems a lot more like isn't joking. It's just a lot more serious.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a sting to it. You know, we
right.
use humor in different ways, but there's often a nasty sting in the background, and we just want to be mindful of that, you know, mindful that our critic is not leaking out in different ways, either with ourselves or with loved ones and whatnot. So
we have a few minutes, and I want to give you the opportunity to talk about, there's so much good stuff in your book, Make Peace With Your Mind. Are there any particular areas that you feel really strongly about, or that you've had a really, you know, maybe some kind of interesting response from with your during your workshops that are really helpful?
You mean in terms of
like tips or techniques or even, you know, ways to think about your mind or tricks to practicing mindfulness or self-compassion?
Yeah, no, many. I mean, I think for me, one of the main tools that I've used, and I teach a lot, and when I teach these workshops on the critic, they're actually quite light and playful because I use a lot of humor. Because, as I quote in the book, as Wavy Gravy says, if you don't have a sense of humor, it just ain't funny anymore. And it is so important that we laugh at ourselves, that we don't take ourselves so seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more that we can find humor, like, I mean, the critic is sometimes humorous. One of my teachers would have me count my judgments in a day. So I'd be on retreat and it'd be 223 judgments, 456, 891. And at some point, the number just gets ridiculous and you just have to laugh, you know. Or the critic will say, hey, you know, you've worked too hard. Why don't you sleep? You're not getting enough sleep. You're tired and grumpy. So you sleep and you sleep in. And then when you wake up and it's 9 o'clock, your critic says, you lazy thing, you're such a slob, you're never going to get your life together. And so we see the humor in that we can't ever win with the critic. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Right.
So if we can find lightness and some humor, I dressed up imagine my critic wearing this barrister's English gray wig, you know, the curly locks. And I just, you know, see it as this, you know, rather, you know, stern voice, and I, you know, find some humor in it, or I exaggerate. Yes, I'm the worst meditator in the world, or the worst parent, or the worst driver, or whatever it is you think.
Right.
And then the other thing I think is useful is, you know, we spend a lot of time rationalizing. But no, I'm a good person. I did this nice thing, and I said this thing, and I gave them a Christmas card.
Yeah.
And as soon as we rationalize, we've actually lost our authority because we've given authority to judge, and mostly we want to not be empowering it, not be giving it that much attention. And sometimes, you know, the critic will point out and say, hey, that was, you know, I can't believe that you forgot your, you know, your niece's birthday, you know, and you say, yeah, you're right. I forgot my niece's birthday. Thank you for reminding me. I don't need to be reminded 50 times today about it.
So rather than making excuses like, oh, well, I forgot my niece's birthday, but I forgot it because I've been really busy because I've been doing that, and I also did this other thing and like getting. So don't get defensive with the inner critic, because then you're attaching to what the inner critic is saying. Instead, just say, just acknowledge what he said and let him go. Because it's almost like the more you argue with him, the more he's going to fight back, right?
Yes. And really, you can't win with the critic. It's one of these loops that just keeps going. So what's important is just to, hey, thanks for your opinion. And I say that, thanks for your opinion. Thanks for your point of view. Because the critic really is a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it is. And it's just a bunch of words. And if we don't give it the authority, it's just a bunch of words like there are many other words going around our head. And it's not an issue unless we listen to it. So that's key. So, you know, there's tons more in the Make Peace With Your Mind book about strategies and tools and tips.
Oh, it's so great. And I think it really is, I do really think that you laid it out well, because I think that people can just go in and say, okay, I kind of want to focus on this. And also, the other thing I like is you could start your morning with this and just read one of those little chapters. And if you were doing that every day, you're slowly kind of incorporating things in. If you feel like you don't have time to, if your inner critic is telling you you don't have time to read an entire book because you need to go make money, you can make your inner critic happy by just reading a section of it. It's a lovely book, Mark, and I really appreciate you joining
Thank
me
you.
Today and talking about this. The book is Make Peace With Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You From Your Inner Critic by Mark Coleman. And Mark has a website, which is markcoleman.org. And go to his website, because he has this whole other life that is really interesting. I love your relationship with nature, and there's a lot to be learned from that. So I'd love to have you back to talk about that. I should take a look at your first book.
Please do. I'd love to talk about it.
Because I think it's a way for people, for all of us, to just kind of ground ourselves and get to know even more about ourselves and the wonders of nature and how we can benefit from it. So thank you again, Mark, for joining me.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on the show.
You've been listening to Relationships 2.0. I'll be back next week with another great guest. Be well.
Do you panic when you don't receive an immediate response to a text, email, or voicemail? Do you become clingy or demanding when you feel someone pulling away? Do you stay in unhealthy relationships because it's better than being alone? Or do you avoid relationships altogether? If you answer yes to any of these questions, you may struggle with fear of abandonment. This fear can trigger intense feelings of jealousy and anxiety that result in unhelpful behaviors that ultimately sabotage your relationships. Psychologist Michelle Skeen's powerful book, Love Me, Don't Leave Me, will help you develop a new perspective about yourself and others, and you will learn to recognize and change the behaviors that are hurting your relationships. You deserve to have closer, loving, and lasting connections. To find out how, go to www.michelleskeen.com. That's www.michelleskeen.com.
America's wounded warriors are coming home. After serving on foreign shores, these brave men and women are returning to their families and communities. Many have wounds you can see, and many have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Now that these warriors are back home, they are ready to enter the civilian workforce. To help, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These extraordinary men and women bring proven world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork to the job. And to ensure the right warrior finds the right job, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right match. When you hire a wounded warrior, you hire an intelligent, talented, and committed new employee. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.